Doctor, I've heard someone say that information is the death knell to complacency quite often. And today, we're going to give some information on a subject that is of great concern to you and to all of us at Focus on the Family. And hopefully, we'll dispel some complacency in our listening audience.
Well, we were talking about euthanasia, and Rita Marker is a champion in the anti-euthanasia cause. Her efforts in this area include speaking and lecturing around the world, really. She is a lecturer in human life studies at the University of Steubenville in Ohio, and has written many, many articles on that subject. Is the mother of seven children and two grandchildren. Rita, welcome back to Focus on the Family.
Thank you.
You really do care about this subject, don't you?
Yes, I do.
And for good reason. We were talking last time about some of the implications of euthanasia. Once you open the door to so-called dignified dying or physician-assisted suicide, then there's no place to stop it. It can go through the society, and you get accustomed to killing the unwanted and those that don't measure up and the unproductive. And yet it's coming. If we don't do something to stop it, it is here. More horrible things are right around the corner. Let's talk about some of the court cases today and some of the trends that are taking place. First of all, I'd like you to talk about the Hemlock Society, which has been agitating for so-called dignified death and dying for years. Explain what they're all about.
Well, the Hemlock Society is one of four national euthanasia organizations in the United States. It was formed in 1980 by Derek Humphrey, a former British journalist who had assisted his wife in killing herself by providing her with a cup of coffee laced with poison. That took place in England, and he wrote a story about it later, or a book about it, called Jane's Way, and then later moved to Los Angeles, California, and started the Hemlock Society with his second wife, Ann Wickett. Hemlock has as its major goal the changing of laws to allow for what they refer to erroneously as physician-assisted aid in dying, and I'll explain why that's erroneous later on. The goal is to of the organization, though, is to make it possible for people to request that they be killed and to allow someone else to do that. Hemlock has a political arm, too, and it's called Americans Against Human Suffering. Now, I've heard it said, and I think it's so true, that all social engineering is preceded by verbal engineering. Mm-hmm. You use the pretty words and you can get people to buy just about anything. Certainly, Americans Against Human Suffering is a nice way of referring to an organization that's trying to legalize the right to kill.
Is there something comparable in Canada?
Yes, there are two euthanasia organizations in Canada. There are euthanasia organizations all over the world. They generally call themselves by less descriptive terms than euthanasia. Yeah. But some, for example, in England, they call themselves Exit, and there is New Exit. But back to Hemlock. Hemlock has proposed legislation. They proposed it in California in the form of an initiative, calling it the Humane and Dignified Death Act. And in the promotion of that, when they were doing that, they described this as a bill that would allow for physician-assisted aid in dying, only for those who chose it and only for those who were qualified patients. Many people went along with that idea and said, well, I wouldn't really want to do it. But if someone chooses to do this, it's their life. When they were attempting to gather enough signatures last spring and did not gather enough signatures, but they're going to try again.
They got 200,000 signatures. I think they needed, what, 375,000?
They needed 376,000 to get it on the ballot. And they said 200. I understand that it was not, that they got 200,000. I understand they didn't even get quite that many. But it's helpful to look at that specific piece of legislation because, you know, they called it physician-assisted aid in dying. Do you know that if that law had passed, that any licensed health professional working under the direction of a physician could have carried out what was called aid in dying? Now, let's kind of take that apart. Aid in dying meant any medical procedure that swiftly, painlessly, and humanely terminated the life of a qualified patient, killing the patient. Licensed health professional. Do you know that in California that includes an acupuncturist or a dispensing optician or a hearing aid dispenser? Any of those people could have killed patients at the direction of a physician if that had passed. And what about this terminally ill patient? What about this patient that would have requested this? Well, that was anybody who was diagnosed or misdiagnosed as having 6 months to live. But you could have requested it years before and said, you know, if I ever get in that situation. And then the doctor or someone working under their direction could have killed that person without their even requesting it again, without their knowing it. As far as it being voluntary, there was nothing in that law for any penalty if somebody tricked somebody into signing a request. In most other laws, if you fraudulently induce somebody to sign something, you get hit with a penalty. Not in that.
We dodged a bullet here in California with regard to that particular legislation, although I'm told that, and I'm sure it's true, all 200,000 of those names, or however many they got, are still in the computer. So during the next election, they start with that base. They have all of those names, and then they pick up from there. So they will eventually get it, I'm told, that this will eventually be on the ballot in the state of California. Do you agree with that?
Well, I agree that they're going to continue to make that attempt. It's also planned for 1990 for the ballot in Washington, Oregon, Florida, and Arizona. And if we're looking at other places where specifically this sort of proposal has been made, in Canada, the Canadian Euthanasia Organization now is distributing their form of the living will, which includes the request for aid in dying.
All right, let me press you for details, Rita.
Right.
Are you in favor of keeping comatose patients alive by artificial means?
Well, I think it would depend on what you say artificial means. I would say that I would like to stick with the bottom line of saying I oppose killing people. In no way am I saying that we should use every possible bit of medical technology to keep everybody alive until the machine breaks down. But let's do be specific and let's talk about what is often being described as keeping the comatose alive by artificial means. A current case, or a recent case, is that of Marcia Gray in Rhode Island. Marcia Gray is hospitalized, although according to the hospital, she does not need acute care. She is not terminally ill. She is described by the newspapers as being comatose. She is not. She is profoundly disabled as a result of brain damage following a stroke. She's 49 years old. In news reports, it is referred to the fact that she is being kept alive by artificial means. And yet her status is comfort care only. This means she is not on any type of machine, not on a respirator. In fact, if she develops an infection, she will not receive antibiotics or anything of this sort. She is not being kept alive by all types of medical procedures.
And yet they want to remove fluid and food from her.
The request of the court and the one that the court gave permission on October 17, 1988, was to remove the food and fluids that she was receiving. That is the only thing that is still remaining. What happens if you remove food and fluids? If you remove food and fluids from anyone, no matter how able-bodied, they die. So this is not medical means of prolonging life. This is just the plain, ordinary sorts of things. So I am opposed to killing anyone, be they referred to as or actually comatose. I do not in any way say that we must use all medical technology.
Rita, there's obviously a lot of money behind this movement, and you have to ask why. Just on the surface of it, having absolutely no information, speaking for myself, it would be to the advantage of insurance companies to have people check out early rather than have to pay those enormous health care bills, which in the last 6 months of life usually exceed health care expenses for the rest of life combined. Any concern there that, you know, that somebody's behind this thing? Who's pushing it?
Well, I think that we should recognize that that is a real probability. We also have to be very cautious that we make certain and know whether that is taking place.
You're not making that charge. I don't want to get all the insurance people down my neck here. But
I'm not making that charge, although if someone were to say, does that mean that they are not involved, I would not go so far as to say that there is no involvement either.
Well, who is behind this thing? I mean, why is there such passion around this movement?
That's a very good question, and I think so many things have converged to cause this to take place at this time. I believe that we're looking at the idea of health care costs and cutting costs. We're looking at AIDS and people who really have a very tremendous bias against those with AIDS. We're looking at the aging of the population and younger people saying, well, I'll be caring for these older people. We're also looking at a situation where many of us have reached a stage where we want to be totally in control, and we cannot wait for things, and so we see this as a method of control without recognizing what's happening. So many things that we can't put our finger on one thing.
If I had to guess, Rita, I'd bet the ACLU is involved in it someplace.
You win. You're definitely right. The ACLU is very involved. For example, they have taken a very official position saying that they are in favor of consensual euthanasia. But there's a more interesting involvement that occurred in Colorado in a recent case there. A young man by the name of Hector Rodas took an overdose of drugs, and it caused a stroke. He was left quadriplegic, although doctors did say that he could begin to regain the use of his arms and so forth. Hector Rodas, following his accident or his overdose, was divorced by his wife. He also realized that he would never be able to work as a mechanic again. That had been his job. And he made it very clear that he wanted to die by starvation and dehydration. Now, the place where Hector Rodas was being cared for, Hilltop Rehabilitation Center in Colorado, questioned his decision because Hector Rodas, they felt, was probably and rightfully so depressed. So the hospital said, look, you have made the request to be starved to death. We want the court to decide whether you are competent to do this. Enter the ACLU to assist Hector Rodas. And the ACLU worked feverishly to convince the court that Hector Rodas did indeed want to die and wanted to be starved to death. Ironically, the decision of the court saying that he could be starved to death took place on January 22nd. But that wasn't the end of the story. The ACLU's involvement went further. They filed with the court a request that since Hector Rodas had been granted the right to die of starvation and dehydration, that he had the right not only to die, but the right to a dignified demise. Therefore, they requested that the judge order that the hospital provide a lethal injection to end his life swiftly rather than through the pain and discomfort of starvation and dehydration. An enterprising young reporter went to the hospital to visit Hector Rodas and asked him point blank, did you request a lethal injection? Did you request that the ACLU petition the court for your right to receive a lethal injection? And Hector Rodas responded using his letter board, no. He had not asked the ACLU to request that the court allow him to be killed by lethal injection. Immediately, the ACLU withdrew the request and the records were sealed. Following Hector Rodas' death, however, they were reopened and this was reported. ACLU did not stop there. 2 days before Rodas' death, they went back to him and asked for his permission to file yet another suit. They filed a suit against the health facility where he had been a patient, filed suit on battery charges, charging the healthcare facility for having fed Hector Rodas from the time that he requested starvation until the time that the court ordered it. Now, after all of this occurred, someone went to the ACLU's Denver office and said, oh, this was really terrible that this request was made. And the ACLU representative responded by saying that it was really unfortunate that the reporter had gone and checked with Rodas, that this case would have been a very good case.
That's phenomenal. And the ACLU purports to be for individual rights. And yet there seems to be a larger agenda there someplace, doesn't it?
Yes, unfortunately, what is going on is that they are attempting to promote what they think is the right thing to do for someone else, not the rights of the individual.
Rita, there was a court case I want you to comment on concerning Mary O'Connor that a lot of us got excited about, but our excitement was short-lived. Explain that to us.
Oh, it was a wonderful case. It was the case of Mary O'Connor, a 77-year-old woman in New York. Mary O'Connor had had several strokes, and her daughters had requested that she not be fed, continue to be fed. Mary O'Connor was not comatose, and this was acknowledged by everyone. If you walk into Mary O'Connor's room and say, what's your name? She says, Mary O'Connor. And if you say, how are you, she'll say, all right or okay. And her daughters felt that Mary O'Connor would not want to continue to be fed because she had always said she didn't want to be a burden. The New York Court of Appeals said Mary O'Connor had the right to be fed. And in fact, she will continue to live comfortably as she is doing now. That was a major case, even though the Society for the Right to Die called it disappointing. It was a major case in recognizing that one of the highest courts in a state, or the highest court in one state, had said people have the right to continue to receive food and fluids. But 3 days later, another court decision was handed down in the state of Rhode Island. It was the first time that a federal court had expressed the fact that there is a federal constitutional right to die. And that particular decision will enable or will order a hospital which had been fighting to continue to provide food and fluids for a profoundly disabled woman. That has now ordered that hospital to carry out her starvation and dehydration. Many people...
Based on, as I understand it, Roe v. Wade.
The decision is based on Roe versus Wade, saying that those rights available that we see in Roe versus Wade carry over to here.
Boy, Mike, this emphasizes to me again the importance of judicial appointments. Mm-hmm. You know, those individuals sitting on the bench had to be appointed, the federal bench anyway, had to be appointed through the Department of Justice by the president and confirmed by the Senate. And we simply must watch that process and who's being put into those positions of judgeships, because we can't get our hands on them. If we don't like what senators and congressmen do, and even the president, we can vote them out of office. We can't get our hands on those judges once they get into those positions. That may be the most important thing a president does, is appoint judges who hold to a traditional value system.
It also speaks to our involvement in local elections, too, and taking the time when we do have elections come around to really understand who we're voting for, because those people are going to ultimately be voting on legislation such as what was proposed in California and elsewhere.
In fact, it is most difficult to get information about the judges that are up for election. You know, I often go into the polling places and wish I knew a little more than I do. And I'm in a position to get the information here. I'm sure many people look at those names and have no idea who they are. We're obligated to know that.
We definitely are, and here's where we need to take the responsibility and to say and to look and to learn about the people that will be making these crucial decisions.
Are you encouraged at all, Rita? We've been talking about some heavy stuff for 2 days. Can you give us some hope in somewhere?
Oh, yes. I'm encouraged by a lot of things. One is that we do not see the firm entrenchment of the media in the pro-euthanasia camp that we do in the pro-abortion camp. They're toying with it, but our task force has been doing a lot of radio. In fact, we've been averaging 4 or 5 radio interviews a week on this. And with only 2 exceptions in the last 7 months, we have found that the moderators of talk shows, although they start out firmly saying, I support the right to die, by the time that we get to the end are either not sure or are saying, my goodness. So it's so necessary that people learn about this. Another really ray of hope is young people, college students, high school students, are seeing this for what it is, and they say, it's awful, let's do something about it. The last thing is that we really have to guard against being so demoralized by it and saying it won't work. If we look at this realistically, we know that it eventually will turn out all right. God always comes out on top. Good always wins over evil. It may take 2 months or 2 years.
Or a generation.
Or 200 years.
As it did in Nazi Germany.
Right, but it's going to turn out all right. So all we have to do is to say, what side am I on? That's all we're asked to do.
To coin a phrase, Mike, from our film series, this is a winnable war. I really believe this is one that if you get an opportunity to just lay the facts before the people, even those who don't come from a Christian perspective, I believe we can win this one.
Oh, yes.
But we've got to get going. We have to do our educational tasks along with those who are using the media to get their point across.
Yes.
In a way quite different than abortion, this euthanasia issue has the potential of touching every single one of us at some point.
And remember that Dr. C. Everett Koop said that this is going to be a greater problem than abortion because of this aging population. Uh-huh. By the year 2000 in Canada, 21% of the people will be above 65. There used to be 5 workers for every 1 retired person to support Social Security and health care and so on. By the year 2000, there will only be 3. So there is going to be a great pressure, and the convenience of giving a little nudge to those that are already about half gone anyway is going to have an appeal, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. One thing I would like to suggest, too, that when people wonder what can they do, obviously education and prayer and so many things, but there's another thing I would like to suggest to everybody that's listening, and that is that when we see people who are older or who have illnesses, whatever it may be, that we make a concerted effort to remind ourselves to see people,
yes,
rather than to see the person's disability or their illness.
Mm.
And if we begin to consciously do that, that can make a tremendous change in not only our own attitudes, but the attitudes of society. Because we have to see every person as the person they are and take away all of the trappings of whatever it may be that makes us feel uncomfortable. This is another human being, and we have to see them.
And we're not on a hierarchy. There aren't some more valuable than others. It's not based on productivity. It's not based on intelligence. It's not based on competence. It's not even based on quality of life. We all have worth. We all have dignity. We all have human value just because God gave it to us. We hammer away at that frequently here, Rita, because I believe that is a fundamental in the Christian faith.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Mike, with just a few moments left, let's go back to the little pin that has the white rose and red rose on it. I have a little card here that says the Weiss rose. Is that
Weiss
what they call
rose.
It? Weiss rose, that's German, which means white rose, was a resistance group of students formed at the University of Munich in 1942 who opposed the Nazi euthanasia programs. 40 years later, in contemporary America, and I'm sure Canada too, legalized euthanasia, suicide, and assisted suicide are again being promoted, threatening the lives of thousands who are vulnerable because of age, disability, or dependence. Once again, people of conscience are called to the spirit of the White Rose to promote and defend the rights of all members of the human family to be treated with respect, dignity, and compassion. This pin incorporates the symbol of the White Rose with that of the Red Rose, the traditional symbol of life. Rita, you are a special friend. We have long been concerned about this euthanasia problem, but you have articulated it well. With seven children, some of them still young. What's your youngest child?
Seven.
Oh, my.
7 years of age.
They're 26, 25, 23, 22, 21, 9, and 7.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Well, when you and I were in my office before we came in here, we prayed. I prayed. And I said, Lord, I know that Rita did not need the additional pressure and stress of an effort like this, of an assignment that you have given her to convey these thoughts and these ideas, but you've accepted it. You have plenty to do at home. Why are you doing this?
I believe this is what God wants me to do. That's
as simple as that.
Yeah.
Well, I believe that too. And to that degree, I appreciate you being here. Keep us informed. This is a rapidly moving problem, isn't it? It's not static. It will be different 12 months from now than it is now.
Most definitely. Most definitely.
Well, you stay in touch with us.
I will.
Well, our courageous guest has been Mrs. Rita Marker, the co-director of the Human Life Center at the University of Steubenville in Ohio, and she also directs the International Anti-Euthanasia Task Force, which is a division of the Human Life Center. And this program has been furnished by Focus on the Family. Your host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson, and I'm Mike Trout, inviting you back tomorrow when we'll again turn our hearts toward home.